So today is September 23rd, 2015. I'm Rick Hansen, and I'd like to talk about what we can do when it gets hard, and especially when you're, in a sense, outnumbered, overpowered, the fix is in, it just ain't gonna happen, that dog just ain't gonna hunt, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where, in other words, you're sincerely, let's say, and let's say virtuously, even trying to have something happen, and it's just not going to happen. You're grappling with some significant difficulty. And I've been through a fair amount of that lately in my own life. I'll spare you the details to protect the guilty as well as the innocent. I think a lot of people are in situations often, some people all of the time, where they're just swimming upstream, or in fact, are just being swept out to sea. What to do about it? What to do about that? And in many ways, that was the Buddha's central preoccupation. What to do about conditions, ordinary life conditions, as well as the conditions in our own mind that are unreliable and unsatisfactory in some sense, continually changing, falling apart. What to do about that in ordinary terms, and also in ways that can take an individual who's not claiming any sort of metaphysical, supernatural powers or resources, can take an individual who's simply practicing with one's own body-mind all the way to ineradicable, stainless, as the Buddha put it, happiness, which is peace. How to actually do that. And so I think there are many examples, large and small, where we're in situations where it just, we're not going to prevail. We're not going to win that election. We're not going to get through to that other person. Our project isn't going to work. This pregnancy is not going to hold. This child is not going to live. This beloved friend is never going to talk with you again. Right? What to do about that? Really, what to do? And so I had a few things to offer about that, including one of the better known stories in the Pali Canon, the collection of teachings related to the first teachings of the Buddha, and that came out in Buddhism. So I wanted to offer some suggestions, and you might make it real by thinking about a particular situation. You know, maybe an illness that's just, it's not going to go away. Maybe a interpersonal situation where the other person just won't repair with you, and you can't get them to repair. Maybe a situation where you've tried to convince someone that X would be good for them or Y would be bad for them, and you love them dearly, and they're just not wanting to hear it. What it could be, you know, it could be conditions out in the world, you know, situations where despotic governments are intensely motivated to do things that are harmful to their own people or to other people. What do we do, right? Well, first I want to say that we do everything we can. Let's just start there. Let's assume that what we want to have happen has some wholesomeness, some reasonableness, some virtue in it. It's, you know, we're stipulating that for the record, and we're also stipulating that we've made the skillful efforts that we can. We're not sitting on our thumbs contemplating our navels. We may be contemplating our navels, but we're also speaking truth to power and doing the best we can. So let's acknowledge that as well. Let's assume all that. So now at this point, the focus is, how do we practice with our own minds? Because in some senses, the animals who are our ancestors, including and also human animals, hominid and early human ancestors, the ones who went, let's say, their equivalent of all radical acceptance, were less likely to pass on their genes. The ones who kept banging their heads against the wall were more likely to pass on their genes, even if a lot of them got bloody heads in the process. So what do we do? How do we practice with our own minds? So my first suggestion is to have compassion for yourself. Ouch. It hurts. It's hard. It sucks. For every person I've known, and I grew up in LA and I knew a few, who were major league whiners or any little thing like, oh, I can only get 4 bars, not 5. You know, like for every one of those, I've known 19 people, if not 99 people, who understated to themselves, let alone others, the degree to which they were grappling with something really hard, the degree to which it really did suck. So compassion for oneself, the wish that one a being not suffer applied to oneself, usually with warmth. And as part of that, of course, thinking about what would protect and fuel me? Where can I take refuge for dealing with what's going on here? Sometimes I just need a break. Sometimes I just need to rent a comedy, take a bubble bath, jump up and down 20 times saying, this sucks, this sucks, this. Yeah, like whatever your thing is. Sometimes that's what we need. Or go on retreat or go to temple, sit with a tree, or just have a big bag of popcorn. Make a batch of chocolate chip cookies and eat them all. You know, whatever. Okay, whatever that is. Have compassion and fuel yourself. Protect yourself, including drawing on others, drawing on wisdom, good company, walk your dog more, talk to your dog more. And, of course, have compassion for the others, for their sake, to be sure, but especially for your sake. Even the others who have harmed you or who are harming others realize that in their own way, there may not be much evidence of it as they fly around on their gold-plated jets and whatnot, but they're suffering too. It'll make you feel better. Compassion is flagging that, especially for yourself. The second suggestion I have is to see the causes and conditions, to just recognize how you really are outnumbered. I mean, I think about historical examples. The advent of World War II, Nazi tank divisions rumbling over the fields of Poland, being met by cavalry charging on horseback. Like, that's not going to end well, at least for the cavalry people and horses, right? Seeing when you're outnumbered, seeing when the fix is in. Politically or otherwise. I don't mean any of this as supporting giving up too soon or anything like that. We're assuming we're doing everything reasonable we can. But where you just see the larger conditions, you see those other people. They're well-intended, but maybe they're deeply conventional. Maybe they themselves are flooded. And because they're flooded, they're rigid and dogmatic, and they're just not going to budge to integrate what you've got to say. The great early child psychiatrist, psychologist Jean Piaget pointed out that there are two kinds of learning. One kind he called assimilation, where we draw information into an existing framework without changing the framework. We kind of fit it in. And then he said there's a much more sophisticated, difficult, and uncommon form of learning, where we accommodate to new information, and we actually shift our frameworks to make room for it, sometimes quite radically. For many people, accommodation in terms of causes and conditions is something that, they've never done in their life. They're not used to it or incapable of doing it. There might be issues inside their own mind. They're just not going to take that in. Or maybe they're so themselves, out of good intentions, kind of freaked out and panicked by what's happening, that they flood the space with their anxiety and activity, and there's no room for anything else to come in that would actually help things get better. Sometimes you're dealing with large-scale systems, classrooms, teachers with 20, 30 kids, and yet you're an advocate for your child, but in the causes and conditions, there just isn't the bandwidth to deal with it. So I want to stress, or think about corporations, businesses, people whose livelihood it is to make certain goals happen. And that's their job every day, and that's how they feed their children. I think it was Upton Sinclair who had a line. He said, to paraphrase, he said, you cannot convince someone of something that it is their paycheck not to believe. So causes and conditions, seeing the whole, and seeing the vast whole, the bigness of humanity, the power of history, the generational intensity of systematic oppression, discrimination, prejudice, structures, vested interests that benefit from things being certain ways. You know, it's just, it's the whole thing. Even seeing the larger cause and condition of our biological evolutionary nature, right? That we get intense, we fire off the handle, we want things to be a certain way, and when they're not that way, we don't care. We still want them to be a certain way. You know, that's part of our causes and conditions. The ways we're critters, we're big scared monkeys, basically, with a temper, speaking personally. So I think that's really helpful to see the larger whole. It can really help. And it goes to very deep teachings in the Buddhist tradition around what's called equanimity, evenness, balance, and emptiness. The fact that any single thing may exist, but it does not have absolute self-arising. It arises due to causes and conditions made up of many parts. This is certainly true for any element of the mind, any thought, any sound, any memory, any desire, and so forth. So it takes us out into the vast web, the vast tapestry. Okay. The other piece of seeing the larger, you know, causes and conditions is to the extent that it's real practice for you, which I recommend, and we've been exploring from time to time in here, is to be the whole, to open out into the whole of your mind, your whole experience, the whole wallpaper, the whole movie, the whole symphony playing, not just one instrument, struggling with another instrument, and also opening out into a sense of being the whole in a very broad sense, including the sense that whatever's happening here is a local patterning of allness. It's a local expression of the vastness of reality altogether, currently and contextualized in time, in culture, society, biology, and so on. You know, it's sort of like be the wave, knowing it's a local expression of ocean, right? Be the whole, including the part. That's the second suggestion. My third suggestion is non-aversion. The Buddha spent a lot of emphasis on our reactions to what's unpleasant. And to, as a way of seeing that, that's quite interesting in terms of one of the elements of the Eightfold Path, wise intention. Two out of three of those intentions, core intentions, the Buddha is saying, man, you know, pursue, give over to these intentions, and that will fuel you on your journey toward awakening. It's that important. What are they? The intention for non-harming and non-ill will, both of which have to do with aversion to the unpleasant. There's also the intention to not grasp after or chase after what's pleasant. Two out of three having to do with the unpleasant. And you can watch it in your mind. Aversion. It's that pushing away. Not right. Don't like it. Go away. Bad. You know. And it's very interesting to realize that a fundamental condition, really, for kindness and compassion, very important practices in all kinds of ways for all kinds of people, certainly central to Buddhism, loving kindness and compassion, central to that is non-aversion. How can we be compassionate toward or kind toward that which we have aversion toward? So tracking aversion and seeing what it's like to explore, do I really need to have aversion to this? I can recognize on a principled basis how extraordinarily unjust it is, how it, we, you know, we should do everything we can to have it not be the case. But do I need to have in my own mind a quality of warlikeness toward that which is unpleasant, not right? And as part of non-aversion, you can watch it in your mind. I'm speaking from my personal experience of the last couple months, especially dealing with a lot of stuff in my larger family system. And you can just see it in your mind, the aversion, like somebody says something and you can just feel your face squinch. You can see aversion in other people really easily. You can kind of feel it in your own facial muscles. They see that thing and you just, you know, you maybe you're well trained, but you don't reveal it entirely. But you can just feel it, or you can just feel your body tensing. Like, you know, you just start the movement into fight or flight, or freeze. Freeze is a kind of aversion, a human equivalent of playing dead in the animal kingdom. And you can also see in your mind this wanting it to be different, right? And it's very important to be able to have a principled view about, you know, feeding children is better than starving them, okay? While at the same time watching this pressure in the mind that arises that, you know, gets, that struggles and wants things to be different than they are. And that's a really high art, including not using, as John Wellwood pointed out, spiritual bypassing to lose your nerve or your voice or your heart, you know, for the sake of the greater good. Okay, that's the second one. I think these are all things we can be aware of, you know, and if you ever want, you can go back and listen again to this talk. Let's see. The fourth suggestion I have is to be impeccable oneself. Oh my goodness. It is so easy to lose our own code when other people don't treat us well. If we think there's an injustice, because let's say there really is an injustice. It's so easy to just say, well, I won't swear on tape here, but you too, you know? I can make some, I don't know, I'm not Italian, whatever, my background, some gesture, I don't know what it is. But anyway, you know, it's so easy to go there, isn't it? To just lose it. And to say, well, if you're not going to pull your weight, why should I, you know? And I think there's a place where at some point we disengage. We say, look, causes and conditions here, takes two people to haul a log, you're not going to haul your end, I'm going to move on to other logs and other people and other projects, right? Or maybe look for sticks that I can carry myself. But it is really tempting to lose that, and yet to retain our impeccability is a great refuge to hold on to what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. Isn't that such a great refuge? To know in your mind, it's kind of like sometimes these things show up in emails, right? Or in communications for how people are. You send an email, seems straightforward. It's kind of like you hit, I used to play tennis with my wife. We would have rallies, which was really fun because she was terrible and I was okay. So we were both challenged because my job was to hit it back to her so that she could return it to me. And when she hit it to me, it was like, whoa, you know? And then I had to hit it back to her and, you know what I mean, right? That was like, okay. So you hit the ball across the net. It's like, straightforward, and then what comes back to you is sort of a big bag of garbage, smelly brown paper and flies, and you're like, what? And it's such a refuge, once you get past the normal human shock, to look at your originating email, what have you, or whatever it was, the thing you said in the meeting, or the order in which you served the food, right? Or whether you brought flowers or didn't to the gathering, something, and you look internally and you go, I just can't find it. You know, it's such a refuge to have that sense, or to go, well, there was that word, which, you know, reasonable people might disagree about, but on the whole, it just, there's not a lawful connection between what you do and what happens. That's such a wonderful refuge. Being impeccable in self. And that goes to the teaching story that the way I heard it is in the African-American tradition. I'm not entirely clear about the origin, but that's the, for me, it's a phenomenal teaching story of Brother Rabbit and the Tar Baby. And as I understand it, and you might know the story as well, Brother Rabbit is this sort of funny trickster character. And Brother Rabbit, you know, is walking by a patch, and in there is some kind of creature made of tar, sticky tar. And this creature, the tar baby, insults the rabbit character walking by. Where they maybe get into some kind of conversation, something happens. Maybe the so-called tar baby doesn't do anything, but for some reason, the rabbit is angry. So the rabbit hits the tar baby. Now the hand is stuck there, right? And then this really makes the rabbit angry. And the rabbit then kicks the tar baby. Now really stuck, right? And then hits the tar baby. Kicks the tar baby in. Whoop! In my telling of the story, I'm embellishing a little. You know, I can see the screenplay right now. You know, stuck totally, right? As they say, you know, back in the day, what you resist persists. We get caught up in a kind of war with others. You know, composing our rebuttals to them late at night when we should be asleep. Really getting aggravated, scorekeeping, really getting caught up in our own grievances, the stance of aggrievedness or a reproachfulness. And that whole process really gets in the way of being impeccable ourselves. Plus, using the metaphor of the Buddha, it involves tons of second, third, and fourth, and fifth darts we throw ourselves. On top of the very understandable first dart in his metaphor of the hurt that comes when you've been dismissed or sidelined or stonewalled in your sincere efforts to help things get better, or the first start of normal human social pain when you're excluded or left out, or there's an injustice, the first start of those you care about, whom you may know personally or may be people far away or people close at home you don't know well, and they've been mistreated. It's natural to have first dart reactions to that, much as if you drop a brick on the foot of a Buddha, it's going to hurt. It's natural to have these kinds of reactions. And it's so powerful, and the Buddha spent a lot of time talking about this, to track the difference between first and second darts. The second darts being the ones we throw ourselves, usually saturated in some way with some quality of selfing. Me, my position, my advice, my stature, you know, my role, my cause. How dare you do that to me? Who do you think you are relative to me? All the rest of that. You know, communications about position and hierarchy, social hierarchies, right? So right there, get out of the war. Don't headbutt the tar baby and be impeccable oneself. That's what we do have influence over. That's my third suggestion, I think. No, that's my fourth suggestion. You're lucky, I'm going to be done soon. Anyway, my fifth suggestion is not to cling. I mean, it's really interesting. I went on retreat once, and I just kind of summarized the whole thing in four words. You know, love more, cling less. That was the personal practice takeaway for myself. Love more, cling less. You know? And Joseph Goldstein wrote a book called One Dharma about various strands of Buddhism, and he said it's very, very clear that none of the many diverse paths and strands of Buddhism, Zen, Tibetan, Pure Land, early Theravadan Buddhism that I'm kind of rooted in my tradition, none of them say cling more, right? They have that in common. And so non-clinging shows up in a lot of ways. One is, don't cling to external conditions having to be a certain way. I mean, yes, obviously, that's where we aspire. We try to help them be better, but can we aspire without attachment? That's a kind of clinging, right? And also, non-clinging to our inner process, especially to our positions. The Buddha talked about four objects of clinging, categories. One is views. Isn't that interesting? Getting righteous or right or positional or doubling down on view. It doesn't mean not seek wise view, but don't get attached to the view. You know, it's kind of is like this teaching that reads better in print. Love yourself. Just don't love your self, right? Same with view, same with view. Another major form of clinging is to what happens in the minds of others. It's like, you can't believe they think that. Or you can't believe that they revealed how they actually see you by some way they just turn in the middle of your last sentence. And you just want to get that thought in their head. It's as if you'd like to have their brain be like Neo's in the Matrix. And you just want to jack your wisdom into the back of their head. So, you know, they're on the Rick channel or whatever your name is, 24/7, you know? Yes, Rick. Yes. Sure, Rick. Yes. Lovely. Right? We want to install our view. You know, we reify thoughts, we essentialize them, we entityize them, we turn them into things, we thingify them, and then we want to stick them in and keep them there. And that's a profound form of clinging that creates so much suffering for us, doesn't it? Right? Okay. And then last on non-clinging is, this one's really hard for me, is tolerate unresolvedness. You know, you like, we won't fix it. It won't sort out unresolvedness. It is unresolved. It's going to stay unresolved. We're not going to have that lovely, harmonious meeting of the minds that all therapists crave, you know, and cling to or value. Not all, just a lot of us. Unresolvedness, like, wow, this one may not resolve. It may just still remain messy. Our whole life, you may still have that grudge against me about something that I know I didn't do, but it's just going to be unresolved. Or in this life at least, it's not going to sort out, you know. Tolerating unresolvedness. Okay? Don't cling. And then, good. And then last, have perspective. And it's, again, there's a wisdom here, middle way, where we don't diminish our own pain or the injustice that was done to others. You know, we try to tell the truth about what really happened there. Okay? And to face it. No, it's not that they did the best that they could. They really didn't do the best that they could, or they deliberately did something bad. Right? If that's the truth of things. I'm not talking about not acknowledging the truth of things. This bad thing has happened. There's this increment between fair medical care, let's say, in this large system, and excellent medical care. And, you know, we've been obstructed in moving it up from fair to good to very good to excellent, let alone outstanding. There's really something that happened there. Okay, that said, but it can really help also to put it in the larger whole of the human experience, the biological experience, you know, many, 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 many things. For example, I just kind of came across a very matter-of-fact scientific statement that I didn't know was actually true. It was just kind of in passing, which is that as the Europeans came to the Americas in the late 1400s and then the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, it's a consensus figure that 50 million indigenous people were killed. Largely by disease. 50 million. That's 8.5 Holocausts. That's just like jaw-dropping. You just think of the centuries, the generations, the families, your child gets smallpox. Unwittingly, maybe. Maybe the European invaders, soldiers, settlers, whatever, you took advantage of the situation. Maybe even later on, there are many cases where it's known that it was done deliberately to just kind of clear it out. But think, 50 million, like, wow. And, you know, not the wisdom here is not to diminish one's own need or affront or hurt or thing that happened, but to go, wow, a lot of bad stuff happens. That can help us with our own mind, to put it in perspective. And that's where this, as I said, one of the better known stories in the Dharma comes forward, having to do with a woman, as best we know. And I personally think that these stories are most likely really quite true. There may be some embellishing later on, some spinning to make a key point, but the essence is probably really true. who can make this stuff up anyway? So basically, as the story has it, a woman named Kisa Gotami was married into a family that really mistreated her, in part because she was supposedly so skinny. I think that's the meaning of the word Kisa. And she eventually bore a child, and then the family really appreciated her and treated her well. And then her child grew sick and died. And she was inconsolable with grief, essentially driven mad by grief. She couldn't recognize that her child had actually died. So she went to the Buddha and told him what had happened. You know, my child is very, very sick. He knew the child was dead, but I need your medicine. So the Buddha said, well, I'll make you a medicine, but I need mustard seeds. So your task, Kisa Gotami, is to go to every house in your village or nearby and collect a single mustard seed from a family or a house that has not known death or loss. Okay? So she says, okay, noble sir, I'll do that. So she goes to this first house and says, hello, I need a mustard seed as long as you have not known death or loss. And they say, well, no, sorry, our grandmother passed away last year. Another house. Well, no, our child was lost in a flood. He was fishing and it just carried him away. Oh, okay. House to house to house to house to house. She could not find a house in which they had not known death or loss or something terrible. And so she came back to the Buddha and said, noble sir, I could not find a single mustard seed from a home, a family, a dwelling place that had not known real loss. And he pointed out to her that that was the nature of the larger condition of things. That suffering is very real, and that her child's death is in this larger context. He didn't disrespect her. He didn't say, oh, Kisa Gotami, you need to go full new age and just think that everything's for the best everywhere always, and it's Pangloss and Candide. But no, he didn't do that. He didn't disrespect her. He met her where she was, and he helped draw her directly into a larger teaching of her shared humanity, her common humanity. Right? And purportedly, on the spot, she had some kind of realization there, and she asked to join the gathering, the congregation, and become a nun and follow the Buddha's way. And he said, sure, I will accept you into this path. And then she did practice and so forth from there. So that's the first of the two stories about Kisa Gotami. And for ourselves, and to find that place where we're not pushing away or diminishing our pain or what's happened to others or injustices or just facts, right? Or first starts that have landed. But we're also being willing to see them as part of a larger whole. It strikes me often that most animals have died throughout history in the moment of being eaten by another animal. Not all, but the great majority. And in ways that are far from perfect, the gradual, the pile up the those countless, trillions of deaths cleared the way very imperfectly for adaptive characteristics that increased the odds of survival by 1%, let's say, or some small fraction, to gradually accumulate and be woven into our own DNA here today. In effect, we actually are sitting here tonight and talking and being with each other tonight based on the causes of conditions of the facts that we sit here on top of a vast pile of corpses, most of whom died just bad, just not because they were unfit in some adaptive sense, they just were in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's part of the larger whole. And then there's the part two of the story, which is where I'll finish up and see what you think, and then we'll go home and make some chocolate chip cookies and eat them all. I want to read a piece here from Andy Olensky, a Buddhist scholar that I really appreciate and respect a lot. And Andy tells the story of Mara Rebuffed, Mara represents, in the Buddhist and Hindu tradition, evil, because Mara represents delusion, ignorance, not seeing clearly, not seeing the whole. Okay, so the passage is, so Mara says to Gautama, he finds her basically out as a very developed, she becomes an arahant, the final stage of awakening. She's just fully cooked. And he says to her, what's this? Like one whose son is slain, he starts by taunting her. You sit with a face full of tears, immersed in the woods all alone. Perhaps you are seeking a man. She's a celibate nun. Like he's going full insult there. And she replies to him. She says, long gone is she whose son was slain. One of the great mantras in Buddhism is gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhi svaha. Gone, gone, beyond the gone, beyond the farthest gone, there, Buddha nature. And the Buddha was described, the Tathagata, one who is gone, just opened out into everything. Okay? So that's, she's talking about that. Long gone is she whose son is slain. Men, too, are in that past for me. I do not grieve, I do not weep. And, sir, I'm not afraid of you. So that's the passage. So here's Andy's commentary, which I'll read, and then we'll finish up here. Okay. Andy says, this poem is all the more remarkable when you know the story behind it. The elder Gautami, the character here, is the very same Kisa Gautami who was at the heart of the mustard seed tragedy. As a young woman, she was married into an abusive family who scorned her for being so skinny, Kisa, and for not bearing children. She finally did give birth to a fine, healthy son and was then treated well by her relatives. Alas, the child had some sort of terrible accident as a toddler and was killed. This drove Gautami mad with despair, and she wandered from place to place, clutching her dead child and seeking medicine to heal him. Shunned by all, she was eventually pointed toward the Buddha, who sized up the situation immediately and asked her to seek mustard seeds from households who have not experienced death. This was, of course, impossible, and when Gautami finally realized the universality of death and the fragility of the human condition, she was healed of her madness. Joining the order of nuns, she eventually became an arahant, the fourth stage in the Theravadin system, an awakened one, someone fully awakened. And one of the defining characteristics, by the way, of an arahant is that the absolute last vestiges of the presumption of being a self, an entity, having an I inside, you still know there's a personness, okay, but the I inside goes away, which suggests how much it takes for the last little vestiges of the presumption of I and I-ness and I-ing to fall away. So then Andy continues, in this exchange she is visited by Mara, a trickster figure in Buddhist literature, also Hinduism, who may be considered the embodiment of evil or the personification of the shadow side of the human psyche. He obviously knows what buttons to push and goes after both the personal tragedy in her past and the demeaning assumption that as a woman she must only be capable of happiness if she finds a man. The elder Gautami, this woman now far along in practice, is unmoved by Mara and demonstrates that she has achieved a state of such profound well-being that even the tragic loss of her son is entirely healed. As an arahant, we are to understand the third line of her stanza to indicate that she is beyond any kind of grief, not just the loss of her son. By grief, we're talking here about second dart reactions to things. Because clearly the Buddha himself, when close friends of his in the path died, he was described as feeling moved or sad by the process. Just to be clear again, who would want to be so equanimous that they would not feel anything at the death of a loved one, or really anyone altogether? So it's not a dismissal, it's not about numbness. Okay. This point is triumphantly made when she addresses Mara as an equal, in the language they're using, and declares that she has no fear whatsoever of him. In the light of awakening, Mara, who thrives only in the shadows, is completely exposed. All unconscious tendencies and dispositions are revealed, and the mind is purified of every emotional affliction, including fear. We are told in the text that upon hearing her words, Mara becomes discouraged and vanishes on the spot. That's pretty powerful stuff, isn't it? Both the story of the mustard seed and then a mind, our own mind, that when taunted, when affronted, can simply not treat Mara as the tar baby, not try to headbutt Mara, but just whoosh. To use a metaphor from Tibet, maybe to finish here, and we'll just let this sink in as you like. They talk about a mind that's like the surface of a hot stove outside upon which snowflakes are falling. And the snowflakes fall. At any moment, there is what's there, right? Of course, with knowing and letting go, which is what we practiced again and again during the meditation earlier, knowing and letting go, being present and letting go. The reactions that we have, the second darts that arise, even the first darts that land on us, land on that surface of our own increasingly developed consciousness. And as they say in Tibet, are self-liberated on the spot. Okay. So in your practice and in your sincerity and in your compassion for yourself, may you develop more and more, as the Buddha recommends, a mind in which, as he put it, in terms of the run-up to his own awakening, things may arise, but nothing invades the mind and remains. Nothing invades the mind and remains. Enjoying that highest happiness, he said, which is peace. So let's sit for a minute. I apologize for not having time for discussion. That's a lot there. And in some ways, I think it's actually appropriate because I don't have any claim to a full list, notwithstanding my yellow sheets. And I think there's a lot of this as well that's about mystery. You know, it's more complicated than that. There's more to it than that. And just letting that be how we end tonight in good company with each other for another minute or so of just practice. Be well. Thank you.
Good talk.
Take care. See you. See you soon.
I just want to grab you quickly. Lori's.